Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, beloved author Susan Orlean discusses her new memoir, Joyride, with journalist Chris Borelli. This conversation originally took place October 24th, 2025, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. This episode is presented in conjunction with the American Writers Museum's forthcoming exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture. This exhibit and programming series explores the profound ways writing reflects and influences our understanding of religion. American Prophets opens November 21st, 2025. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hey everybody, how are we doing tonight?
Good?
All right. Yay. We're glad you're here. I'm Cary Cranston, the president here at the American Writers Museum. If you enjoy the types of programs we do here at the AWM, you can become a member and get free admission and discounted tickets to our programs, special events, including our monthly happy hour series, Get Lit, and our upcoming special exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, which opens to the public on November 21st, and we'll get a preview for our members on November 20th. So please feel free to become a member. And we thank you all for being here and supporting the past, present, and future of American writing. And tonight, we're going to celebrate the story of a literary life, from going deep inside the head of a regular 10-year-old boy for a legendary profile, to reporting on a woman who owns 27 tigers, from capturing the routine magic of Saturday night to climbing Mount Fuji. Acclaimed writer and novelist Susan Orlean's memoir, Joyride, is an essential and practical guide to embracing any creative path. Susan Orlean has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1992. She is the New York Times bestselling author of 7 books, including The Library Book, Rin Tin Tin, Saturday Night, The Orchid Thief, which was made into the Academy Award-winning film adaptation. And she lives with her family and her animals in Los Angeles and currently is a board member of the American Writers Museum. So she will be interviewed tonight by Chris Borelli, a longtime features writer at the Chicago Tribune and a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. So please join me in welcoming our guest tonight.
Okay, so we were talking about this backstage a little bit, and I thought I'd start with this. Years ago, I interviewed you, and I brought a list of questions, and I remember distinctly you winced at the list of questions. So I got to ask you, does my list of questions bother you?
I would like to push back against that, okay, which is okay. I have a lot of habits as a writer, and I write a lot about those ways of going about my business in the book. But I also feel really strongly that they are not prescriptive. They work for me, and I feel like the most important thing is to do what works for you. I have reasons that I will argue in favor of the way I do business. For instance, I don't use a tape recorder. Mm-hmm. I really prefer writing by hand, and I have reasons. I can explain to you why I prefer that. For instance, I feel like you listen harder when you're writing by hand. If you use a tape recorder, you have a tendency to let your mind wander. Secondly, I think tape recorders are much more alienating to people than even the fumbling awkwardness of writing by hand. So I have lots of reasons I do what I do, but I also feel like you should do what is the most effective and comfortable for you. Writing out questions, I mean, I know a lot of people, when I say, no, I never write down questions and I don't like preparing, a lot of people think, well, that's insane. And I think there's a good argument for preparing and having written notes. I just don't happen to hold to those arguments.
You don't prepare at all?
I don't not prepare at all. I do want to, sound like I'm not just stumbling or sleepwalking through my experience as a reporter, but the way I don't read a guidebook before I travel somewhere, sure, I may flip through it just very informally, but I really want to be there and I want to happen upon what I happen upon. If I miss something, I feel like that's okay because I will also probably see something that the guidebook didn't tell me to see. And that pleases me. If I'm going to write about a subculture or a place, I want to really experience it the way I might encounter it as a complete stranger and not come armed with, you know, chapter and verse of background. I think, again, you listen less well if you already are planning on what you're going to hear.
You guide them into certain directions, maybe.
Or you just make assumptions, or you don't ask questions that really you should ask. Sure. To me, being a writer is being a student. You need to go out into the world and learn things about it. And the best way to learn is to really put yourself in that kind of somewhat challenging position of having to think on your feet and having to learn in the moment. Being overly prepared becomes an impediment in my mind to that experience of kind of discovery and going, well, tell me about fill in the blank. Instead, it's like, I already know about fill in the blank, right. So I'm not going to even ask you.
So then Joyride, your new book, is a memoir, and that's obviously, you're prepared, right? You come to it prepared. You know the subject pretty well, right?
Yes and no.
Did you report on yourself? Is that how you approach
it? I did report on myself, and okay. It's a little harder when it is yourself, yeah. Because obviously, you can't have that complete discovery experience, but I very deliberately did a few things that were explicitly meant to replicate my usual experience as a reporter. The first thing I did was hire a journalist, someone who I know, to interview me. I thought this would help me get my stories out of my head and into the world.
Interview you about your life or about the world?
Everything. I said, just interview me. Mm-hmm. I start at the beginning and ask me questions and ask me what you're interested in hearing about me. And she's a very good writer, very good journalist. So I didn't give her questions. I just said, ask me.
Just ask you.
Yeah. So those transcripts were, while I didn't use them verbatim really in the book, the process helped me begin hearing my story as a narrative. I mean, we all, you know how you sometimes have shorthand in your head for your thoughts and memories and experience, and it's sometimes hard to like slow down and explain it. So she would say to me, wait, but how did you get to The New Yorker? Instead of, in 1986, I started writing for The New Yorker. And, explain. Like, I don't know that story. And
were you doing the things that people do when you interview them? Like, myself, when I interview people, they always assume, there's always a sense of, they talk in shorthand, right? They talk in acronyms and things that, like, they assume that. I always have to stop them and say, I don't go to work with you every day. Like, you have to explain this.
Exactly. This is someone I knew, but she didn't know me well. Right. And she didn't know the kind of chronology of my life. And so she was a perfect stand-in for a reader. She was someone who had an existing interest in the story of my career and my life, but she didn't know a lot about it. So she would force me to explain and often would ask me questions that I hadn't really thought about, which was great. The second thing that I did that was very helpful was some years ago, Columbia University acquired my papers, mm-hmm. and that meant all of the kind of notebooks and letters, notes between me and editors, old book proposals, everything. They just can't. I was very rushed because I was moving, and
you
I
saved
said,
all
"Come."
That stuff.
I saved, well, I didn't remember that I had saved all that stuff. I was surprised, and sure. Including like rejection letters. I mean, it was like, why did I save these? But I'm glad I did.
Wait, hold on a second. Before we go on, I have to ask, what's the rejection letter to you? Are they, is it a standard rejection letter, or are they?
They were actually very encouraging rejections, so maybe I saved them because they were, they weren't pure pain. They were like this... Not interested in this book idea, but we're really interested in what you're doing next, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I saved all of those. Columbia came and got everything out of my office, and I didn't go through it before they took it away because I didn't have time. I didn't really know what was in there. I really didn't, and in fact, there were a few instances where they would call me and say, you know, you have some stuff in here that we don't think you really meant to send.
Like what?
Like my tax returns. And I said, yeah. So I said, no problem. We'll send those back. So they were very kind because legally they now belong to Columbia University. But I thought, you know, I'm going to report on myself the way I would if I were someone I didn't know. And what would I do? I would go look at the archives. I called Columbia. I said, you know, I want to come see my stuff. And they said, well, that's fine. You have to go through the portal and make an appointment. And I said, but those are my papers. And they said, well, we have protocol. So I had to book time and specify which box I wanted to look at. It was incredible because I hadn't looked through this stuff and I was a bit of a pack rat and I did save. I think I always felt like I can't throw this out even though it's of no active use to me.
Sure.
Like my first book proposal. Yeah. I couldn't picture throwing it out even though I would never revisit it. But I saved it.
Was it like reading the papers of somebody else? Like, did it feel like a different person?
Well, yes and no. I felt there was a real sense of discovery, which was great because that emotion, I think, is a really helpful one when you're writing. It gives you, it animates you to tell a story that you feel you've just discovered. At the same time, there was nothing that didn't give me a little pang of nostalgia and think, oh, God, I remember when I got this note or, you know, I was, so it was both familiar and unfamiliar.
Yeah. You know, you write in the book that you were not completely thrilled with writing about yourself at first. Like you didn't want to necessarily write a memoir. I didn't think it was necessarily a great idea to write a memoir. First of all, why did you feel that way? But also, I wonder if, do you see it differently? I guess it is inherently differently, but do you see it differently than you've never been shy about using yourself in your stories, right? So why would that be different to some extent? I mean, it's about your life, right? But to some extent, it's also, you know, there's overlap there.
Yeah, and I've used first person in my stories for a long time,
right.
But I am always the guide and not the story.
Sure.
Although it's interesting, I just re-recorded the audiobook for The Orchid Thief, and I haven't read the book since I wrote it. So that was 25 years ago. It was interesting. I liked it, which is good. but I was surprised by how much first person there was in it. I didn't remember how much first person.
I mean, in a good way or a bad way? Did you?
No, and I mean, it was entirely appropriate to the way I was telling the story. I just hadn't remembered how much first person there was. This was different because for a number of reasons. First of all, I think memoir in the modern era has been synonymous with trauma, that every memoir has to be some, you know, gut-wrenching tale of, you know, whatever terrible trauma you experienced. And this was not that. So part of me felt like, is this interesting if it's not a kind of record of trauma? Secondly, I think anyone who really thinks they deserve to write a memoir probably has some ego problems. I'd like to think that a person with a certain amount of humility has the sort of emotion of like, well, does anybody really care about my life? Mm-hmm. And I felt that, there is a bit of a self-importance that is kind of baked into the idea of doing a memoir. At the same time, I thought, I've been doing this for a long time. And while I hadn't really thought in these terms, it really does track a particular career arc that now looks like it's from another era, practically.
I want to ask you about that. I'm gonna get to that in a second.
Yeah. So, but it took me a while to get over the feeling that who cares about reading my story, and since it's so much of it is really a happy story, I felt like, well, is this going to register in a world in which we're sort of kind of programmed to expect a memoir to be painful?
I mean, did you, hence the title, I suppose, right?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a giveaway when you call your book Joyride.
I mean, did you feel the need to sort of add maybe something a little bit juicier to your own story? Not, I don't mean make anything up, but I mean to make sure that you include things that are...
I felt like it was useful, but also entirely honest, to track the sort of peaks and valleys that the book in many ways is a lot about being determined and seeing, facing a challenge, whether it's a story that sort of falls apart as you're working on it and suddenly you have to think, all right, how can I make this work? Or, as I document in the book, being really late on a book deadline and running into real problems and really being upset, like, what am I going to do? My book is late. I'm in trouble. That's not an easy thing to deal with. And I felt like those were all legitimately part of the story and maybe even helpful to say, yeah, I've had the most fabulous professional life. I cannot imagine a better, more fortunate professional life, but there also have been challenges along the way that had to be dealt with, and I happily included that.
I mean, what you're saying, I don't know how many people know your work really closely here, but I should say that you're very good at the beginning, especially towards the front of the book, about describing the way you kind of meet editors and you kind of end up with some sort of relationship with certain editors, right? And I guess I wanted to ask, I mean, you're pitching stories that are probably to like 90% of editors is completely snoozy, right? Like folding sweaters, right? A story on folding sweaters.
A great story.
Right.
Don't knock it.
Right. But I guess what I'm trying to say is you're pitching things that, and I mean, I run through this myself. You're pitching things that sound very, very mundane, right?
Right.
And I mean, and it requires an editor to have some kind of a vision, to share some kind of a vision with you, right? Or to have the trust enough to kind of let you go write about whatever it is you're going to write about. Even, it might seem completely boring to the average person, right? How important was it when you were starting out to kind of find the right editors that would, give you the room to write about, to kind of go off and write about certain things?
It's so important.
Or not spectacular.
Right. Yeah. It's so important. I think that I needed editors who trusted me and were able to take the chance on stories that just didn't have a big, giant topic.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's really funny. My first real writing job at an alternative news weekly in Portland, Oregon, I was covering music for them, and then there was an opening to be a feature writer. So they said, all right, if you want to move over to that, you can be a feature writer, but you're going to have a beat, and your beat is county government. And I thought, okay, that is the worst beat. Not even city government. I mean, it was so dreadful. Mm-hmm. I was heartsick, but I said yes because I wanted to be a feature writer. I kept coming back with stories that had nothing to do with government, but I would say to my editor, but they took place in the county. And eventually he sort of threw his hands up and said, just go do what you want. First of all, I can't believe I did that, because really I had no right to not do what I was supposed to be doing. But I would come across these stories and I think, oh my God, this is a great story. And I would just do it and then say, yeah, but like, actually it's like 10 miles from the border of the county. It's like thoroughly in the county. And because the stories were good, even though they would never have thought to assign them, he couldn't not run them. And I think he was beginning to think, well, maybe I have to go with this. Maybe I have to trust her instincts and kind of take the chance. Luckily, I've had a series of editors like that. And it doesn't mean that I just do whatever I want. I mean, luckily, I mostly get to do what I wish to do. Mm-hmm. But it's not an indulgence. I think I've had editors who've understood that if I get really passionate about something, I usually can follow through. There's a reason that I'm excited about it. Right. And if I say, I want to know how they teach people to fold sweaters so well at Benetton, and this isn't a long story. It was a short story. But it was a real curiosity. I really wanted to know.
That's a challenge to yourself, too, to say, like, how can I make this interesting, right?
But I never do it if I don't actually find it interesting.
Right.
But I think the writing challenge is, how do I convey to the reader that this story, which they, for perfectly good reason, are going to be doubtful about, how do I make them see why it's actually really interesting? It's something that I get so much pleasure out of that. I've had, over the course of my career, I've so often had people say to me, boy, I never thought I'd read a book about orchids. And to me, you know, I know orchid lovers would read The Orchid Thief. That's not a hard audience, but to have had people say, boy, I have no interest in Florida, I have no interest in orchids, but gosh, you got me. And I ended up reading a whole book. And that's what feels really good. And it's very often the case that me and like almost no one thinks the idea is interesting, or maybe a very, very narrow group of people would find it interesting.
Did you ever find yourself trying to really convince an editor that a story was good, that a story was interesting early on, I guess? Because at some point you become established and they kind of know that you can throw them things that might sound completely dull, but in your voice and your writing, you know, it'll work. But like, for instance, you know, I love that you have a story, I can't remember if it's, I think it's for The New Yorker, about how a supermarket works.
Yes.
Right. Which is it's just how a supermarket works. That's, you know, it's as simple as that. It's a little bit like like John McPhee's Oranges, how what orange production is like, you know, which sounds completely dry, right?
Right.
But it can't, it doesn't have to be, right? So I'm sorry, the point is, when you're pitching a story like that, like what's the response? Are you trying to convince them? Are you?
Yeah, well, it's well, I'll give you an example. And yes, the supermarket story definitely was one where one, and this always happens to me. I was just in a supermarket and for whatever reason, it was like lightning struck me. And I thought, oh my God, supermarkets, how do they work? And I thought, this is the most interesting story I've ever thought of in my life. And I came charging into the office the next day and said, literally, like, this is breaking news. How do supermarkets work? I just want to find one supermarket and spend a couple of weeks there and write about I just want to learn about this little bubble of a universe. And I know that the reaction was sort of, and the thing is that I didn't, it's not like I could say, and what's going to happen is XYZ, because I didn't know what I was going to find. Right. I just said these, I could make a strong argument and say, look, everybody, rich, poor, old, young, we all go to the supermarket. And so it's a crossroad of humanity. There are these very complex retail environments that, you know, are fascinating in and of themselves. They're even more fascinating than I knew because, you know, they're dealing with so many vendors. And and in this case, I chose a supermarket in the most culturally and ethnically diverse neighborhood in the United States. So they were also having to cater to this massively sort of diverse neighborhood of a million different nationalities and people who wanted
food. It's an ecosystem, essentially.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it was genuinely, here's the coolest thing. So this is something I never thought of, probably less true now because people don't use cash. But during the course of the day, back in the olden days when people used cash, when I wrote the story, over the course of a day, think of how much cash they had. And they don't like having so much cash in the store over the course of the days, thousands and thousands of dollars and lots of small bills because some people come in and they buy a banana, literally. So they hired this young man who happened to be developmentally disabled, but he was very responsible and he took cash to the bank like six times a day. So he was part of the ecosystem of the grocery store. Who thought about cash? Yeah. I mean, it had never even occurred to me. So all day long, you know, they would call him over, pack up. So they never wanted him to have too much money. So they did it multiple times a day to go make the deposit at the bank. Well, to me, that was so fascinating.
Yeah.
It was just amazing. And as somebody who just went into a grocery store, bought my stuff, went home, see, that's what's so cool is that you are interacting with this place that you really don't know anything about.
Right.
So it's such a, I love those kinds of stories. Everyone knows what a supermarket is, but really nobody, right, nobody knows how they work.
You're the alien and you've, I've never been to this world before. How does this work?
Except you've been to the world so much, but you've right, never stopped and thought, how do they get the Pepperidge Farm in those little separate things?
Yeah.
Or also it was really funny. Like the guy who was the Pepsi guy had a big crush on one of the cashiers at the supermarket. So he would never give them quite enough Pepsi products so that he could come back like every day to restock the Pepsi.
These are all elements of like short fiction too.
Yeah,
like,
I know. I mean, it was
like a John Cheever story.
Yeah, it was really, and also it was really interesting. It was a privately owned supermarket, which now of course barely exists. And the man who owned it had two sons, but he had worked incredibly hard and made enough money that his sons wanted nothing to do with the supermarket business. You know, one son was like a stockbroker, the other one was a lawyer or something like that. So he had built this business and had no one to take it over, none of his kids. And so to me, it was also an incredible story about upward mobility and how in a way you send your children off so they don't really want anything to do with the world that you made. And it was, so there was a lot of poignancy. And he ended up selling the supermarket. I'm sorry, I'm telling you too much, but he ended up, this is a really cool story. There was a young Hispanic kid who had started as a grocery bagger and worked his way up to being the manager of the store. And he, the guy who owned the supermarket when he retired, sold it to that young man who had become like a surrogate son. So it was an amazing American story that was much more profound than I had imagined going into it.
I mean, there's something about some of your stories. It's incredibly ballsy or brave to assume that you can kind of write a story about something that people experience on a daily basis, right? And, you know, so I'm going to use that as a way of showing you something.
Yes.
So this book is not on her. It's not, you know, in the inside page with list of books that you've written. This is not, I think, so you've written 8 books, actually, not 7.
Well, I've actually written 9.
Right.
Because we were talking about Floral Ghost, too.
Oh, right. Well, I should explain what this
I've
is.
I've probably written more that I forgot. Does anybody remember another book I've written that I forgot to put in?
Well, this came out of, so I'm from New England, and I used to read your column you wrote in the Boston Globe magazine on Sunday, and it was basically this book. The title is Red Sox and Bluefish and Other Things That Make New England New England, right? It's basically a series of columns about aspects of New England, right? And the reason I'm bringing that up here in the Midwest, because I just remember at one point it really struck me as like, this is incredibly brave of somebody from the Midwest to show up in parochial New England and so to say, these are your things. And,
right.
And let me explain your things to you.
Now that you put it that way, now I'm really scared.
Well, I guess I'm wondering is like, did you learn anything from about how you write things and how you approach stories from those kind of columns? Because to me, it's like that's woven throughout your stuff in a way.
Yeah. Well, I sort of savor the Martian on Earth kind of experience. And sure. I was new in Boston, and I found a lot about Boston to be very odd, not in a bad way, but in a odd way. And so I thought, well, I just want to identify these things. For instance, the obsession with the Red Sox or Bluefish, hence the title.
Weird like, pants. I think
like, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Why do men wear red pants with little whales on them?
Yeah.
And and they call them Nantucket Reds,
yeah.
And the more faded they are, the more they like them. So there, it was true. Like observing an Amazonian tribe, and I felt like I never thought, oh, people are going to be irritated because who am I to tell them?
Yeah.
I felt like I never thought about that. I never worried about that, which is probably good because it would be inhibiting for sure. I mean, particularly in a place that's very clannish and people yeah. assume, you know, for instance, people in Boston say things in a funny way. And so they pronounce things in weird ways. So there's a neighborhood in Boston spelled Dorchester.
Dorchester. Yeah.
And yeah, Dosta.
Dorchester.
Dorchester. Yeah.
Right.
Worcester. Yes.
Yeah. Charleston.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Peabody.
And, you know, so I remember feeling like we've got to analyze this. Nobody talks like this except people in Boston. And it was fascinating. I don't worry about that. I mean, look, when I was writing The Orchid Thief, I knew there are people who are so obsessed with orchids who know it can recite the Latin name of every single species of orchid. They're very competitive about it. They're very fierce. Nobody knows orchids better than they do. And I went into it thinking, you know what? I know they're going to give me grief. I know they are. I don't know anything about orchids. And I say it very frankly in the beginning of the book. The reason I did the book was I read a story about a guy who was arrested with a bunch of orchids that he had stolen out of a swamp. And my first thought was, why would you, first of all, I didn't know orchids grew wild in Florida, but why would you steal orchids? Why wouldn't you just go to Home Depot and buy one? And I knew that I would be going right into this group of people who were going to find fault with me left and right, including the mere fact that I had the nerve to write a book about the orchid world.
Fault in the sense that you don't know anything about the world.
I don't know anything about the world. I haven't been collecting orchids for decades. I can't say their Latin names. And I thought, oh, that's fine. I'm not pretending that I know that. And I have a superpower, which is that this is all new to me and I'm discovering it. And I can embrace it with the enthusiasm of a learner.
Yeah.
And it never bothered me. And I braced myself for what I knew would be their nitpicking with the book, but I knew it would happen. And also they all bought the book, so I'm not going to complain.
People like to talk about themselves too.
Right. So exactly. Helps. Exactly. Yeah. And that happens. I'm not an expert in anything that I write about, but that's part of my beat. You know, that is, I'm not really interested. I don't know that much about any particular topic, and I generally am not interested in writing about the things that I do. It's funny because I was in Cleveland yesterday, and that's where I grew up. I've never written a story about Cleveland, and I think part of it is because it feels a little too familiar, even though that's silly. I mean, I grew up there, but it's a big city with a million subcultures. I surely could find a story there, but I think I've never sort of focused on finding a story there because it feels too familiar. But I'm luckily relatively immune to worrying about that particular reaction.
Who were your, early on, who were your journalism heroes? You know, who did you really like that you felt like, okay, here's a model I could use to, I mean, for me, you were sort of one of my
Oh my
models.
God, am I that old?
Kind of. Not, I mean,
heavens.
Clearly not, you know, not that good, but, you know, the general spirit of it was sort of like what I took was like, okay, you can write about anything. Literally, you can write about folding sweaters. You can write about a supermarket, you know, if you sort of have enough interest, right?
Right.
So who offered that to you?
I came onto Tom Wolfe's electric acid Kool-Aid test when I was in high school, and it absolutely blew my mind. And I carried it around, literally. I brought it to school with me sort of every day. And during breaks, I would flip through it and read it. And it modeled for me something I had never imagined you could do, which was to write, not that he was writing about something ordinary, but he was writing about a subculture, immersing himself in it, writing it with a kind of energy and creativity that I had never seen before.
Yeah. All those Esquire guys in the 60s.
Yeah. Especially. Oh, yeah. They were amazing. And actually, I feel really lucky. I grew up in such a good time for narrative nonfiction. And I was reading Joan Didion. I started getting The New Yorker when I was in college and came upon John McPhee, the entire universe, Calvin Trillin, all of those writers who modeled for me, each very different, but they modeled for me a kind of looking at the world, reporting in a certain way, writing in a certain way, and validating a certain kind of topic that absolutely lifted me and made me think, I want to do this. I'll do it my way, but these are my models.
Did you ever meet Joseph Mitchell?
Oh yeah, I met him.
I should say who Joseph Mitchell is probably. Do you guys know who Joseph Mitchell is?
Yeah, he was still coming into the office at the New Yorker when I started there. I got my office in 92. He still came in every day. He hadn't written anything since the 60s.
Famously, Joseph Mitchell was a great journalist for many, many, many decades at the New Yorker. And then I think his last story was it Joel Gould's Secret?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he wrote this very classic piece of journalism called Joe Gould's Secret in the 60s, right? It was published in the 60s. And then he went to the New Yorker.
About a guy with horrible writer's block.
Yes. And once it went, he still went to the New Yorker. He went to his office every day, you know, for what, 30 years?
Yeah.
After?
And
never filed another story again.
Yeah. And I would run into him, see him in the hall all the time. And one time we were waiting for the elevator together and I was just starstruck. And he was this small, portly North Carolina gentleman.
Real thick accent. Right?
Yeah, and wore a hat and, yes, heavy North Carolina accent. Right. And somehow he knew me. Oh, Miss Orlean. And then he said, I really liked your story about whatever story, I can't remember now, a story of mine that had just come out. And I thought, I'm going to die. I'm literally going to die. It was, my start at the New Yorker was the place was still populated by this generation that, you know, sadly were very much kind of at the end of their lives, who my first Talk of the Town piece ran next to one by John Updike. And no one would ever know that because we didn't have bylines.
Right.
And he was writing Talk of the Towns. I mean, it was really an incredible, magical, magical time. And for me to start then, I literally couldn't believe it. It was so thrilling and inspiring and it didn't make me, I mean, Roger Angel, all of these guys who were so amazing, and even though they seem like such gods, in a way, it made me feel, just being around them made me feel like, I'm here too. I can really try to match their work.
This is probably impossible to answer, I suppose, but do you think your career would look differently if you had started in the, you know, the age of clicks, basically, where?
Yeah, and
I should say too that I don't have that pressure so much. I mean, other reporters at the Tribune definitely do. I don't so much because I'm writing really random stuff. So they know that nobody's coming to my stories willingly.
Well, you know, it's such a different universe when you publish a piece in a magazine.
Yeah.
Back in the day, there was no measure of how successful the story was or wasn't. The magazine was out, people bought the issue, no one knew if they were buying it for your story, my story, no one knew how many pages into it the reader would go, none of that. Now, as you know, this is tracked literally to the sentence. People read 5 sentences and stop reading.
I mean, it's tracked throughout the day, throughout the minutes.
Yeah, like, and you know, is this true of the New Yorker? The way, in fact,
I mean, a story could be dead by, you know,
yeah.
I could spend months on a story. It gets published at 10 a.m. and by noon, it could be considered completely just a lost case, basically,
because it didn't
get traction in the same way, right?
Yeah, and I remember, long ago, I wrote a piece for the New Yorker about the hazard of the most popular listing, which is done on the New York Times, it's done on the New Yorker, and the fact is that it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is, and I do this all the time when I'm reading the New York Times, I read the front section, and I do this all on the online. I read it online, not on the physical paper. And then I go to the section called Most Popular. Why? Why do I care what someone else is reading? And yet you feel like, well, if lots of people are reading it, it must be pretty good. And so it becomes more popular because it's posted as a more pop, as a most read story. And, you know, we're in a new world, and I can't fault publications for doing this when you have the technology to measure how much people read of a story. You're going to measure it. It's, you can't blame them for doing it. And this is, you know, the nature of, you have the ability to measure X, so you're going to measure X.
I think one of the things that gives me hope is that when you do look at those lists of the most popular stories right now, I mean, not always, but a lot of times it is the sort of weird outlier pieces,
right,
that,
right,
I mean, they are the ones sometimes that get a lot of interest because, well, they're so like, what?
Right. You know? And word of mouth, or people say, well, this is an interesting story, right, and someone else reads it. Could my career exist in this environment? It's weird. I find it astonishing that my books have sold really well. I've written books about stuff that from the start seemed uniquely unsuccessful as topics. Mm-hmm. I mean, seriously, when I said to my publisher I wanted to do a book about libraries, and there was a little bit of a silence in the room. I said, well, that's lovely, but it, you know, mm-hmm, do people really want to read about libraries? And I just feel like people have the capacity to be more interested in more stuff than we give them credit for.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just ask you this last question and we'll take it over, turn it over to you guys. But the book is so hopeful, and it's so much sort of a portrait of it. I mean, in some sense, another world, right? That, I mean, do you ever feel bad at all about presenting this to everyone? It's like, well, this is how I did it. Here's the steps. I mean, if I read this book 30 years ago, I would have felt much better about my life. You know, but, you know, I guess what I'm wondering is there any guilt behind that? You know, that like, here's how I did it. And yet a lot of this infrastructure just doesn't exist in the same way.
Right. And certainly, I started at alternative news weeklies, and by and large, they are completely gone.
Boston Phoenix, right?
Yeah. Boston Phoenix, Willamette Week in Portland is still around, right, but the Phoenix, the Village Voice, I mean, that's an entire layer of places where people used to start journalism careers.
I mean, the Reader, the Chicago Reader here was as thick as the Tribune for a while.
So that is like saying, kids, get your start in silent film.
Yeah. I always say to people, I feel like I work in vaudeville a little bit.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, there is, so for the people who read it and say, you know, how dare you, I'm not recommending it. I'm simply tracking my career through an era that in many ways doesn't exist. But I can also argue on the other side of it is there are platforms that exist now that didn't exist when I was getting started, and they may offer opportunities, you know, not to be like Substack, Medium, the websites of every single publication has a website that's way bigger than what the original publications were.
Sure.
I mean, the New Yorker website is enormous compared to the page number in the physical magazine. So there are new things that have replaced some of the old things. They're different. If I now were talking to journalism students, I would need to brainstorm with them. What are ways, you know, I used to have a set kind of song and dance. I'd say, move to a small or medium-sized city and get a job at the local paper or at the alternative news weekly, and then start reaching out to magazines. And, you know, I had a whole prescription for what I thought was a good way to go about it. And a lot of those steps, you have to think of another set of steps, because a lot of those just don't exist anymore.
Do you want to turn it over to? Okay.
Yeah, so I hope you guys have questions.
Hi, a huge longtime fan, so super stoked to be here.
Thank you.
kind of like an off-the-wall question, but I was obsessed with How To with John Wilson, and when I saw your name in the credits, I was like, how did that happen? So, like, A, I would love to hear it straight from you, even though, like, I've like read, like, how did that happen, and what was that writer's room like? Like,
that's a great question.
Like, coming into that show and Connor O'Malley being there. Like, how was that?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a funny backstory, as a matter of fact. And for those of you who don't know, How To with John Wilson was a show on HBO, a sort of documentary show that you have to see it to get it. It's hard to explain.
Possible to explain.
Yeah. And it ran for 3 seasons. And what happened was, a couple of years ago, I got a call from my agent, and she said, look, these guys who do this show are obsessed with your first book, Saturday Night, and they just wondered if you would do a Zoom call with them and say hi and meet them. And I thought, sure, yeah, why not? So they had apparently read Saturday Night and felt that it modeled for them. I mean, they said they use it as like their Bible in the first season of the show. Well, I was tickled. I had never seen the show at that point. They said, is there any chance you would consult with us? And I thought, no, yeah, why not? Let me see the show. And I loved the show. I watched it that night and thought, this is amazing. And then they said, well, instead, would you want to be in the writer's room and for a season? And I thought, well, this is an adventure. Why not? It was during COVID, so it was all on Zoom, which was a, you know, crazy, weird experience. Also, if you see the show, you understand why it was not a typical writer's room. It was a kind of essay constructed with documentary footage, some of which had already been shot, some which we thought about that they then went and shot.
It's incredible there was a writer's room at all for a show like
Well, in fact, the third season, they didn't have a writer's room. But, I mean, it was tricky because John had an encyclopedic knowledge of what he already had shot, and we didn't. So that was tricky. But it was very challenging. I mean, John would say, okay, we're doing an episode called How to Appreciate Wine, but I don't want anything about wine in the episode. So we're like, okay, got it. Not really, but we'll figure it out. And it was a really great experience. The people, there were a lot of people from the comedy world, like Connor O'Malley, and not a lot of, there weren't a lot of people. There were five of us. So it was never a lot of people, but it was John and Michael Komen and Connor O'Malley, and then one or two people who floated in and out. It was really fun. It was challenging, not easy, compared to like a fiction story where you can say, let's then have them turn the corner and meet a unicorn. And everyone goes, yeah, great idea. Okay, let's write that. You know, this was different. You were building out of these building blocks of real stories.
That's going to have a second life at some point. That's just one of those.
My unicorn story.
No. The how to yeah. With John. Yeah, because it just has. It's people, so strange, but
yeah.
And so
no,
charming.
People absolutely love that show. They were really.
I actually
passionate.
Stopped watching it only because I felt like if I keep watching this, I'm going to have watched all the episodes, and it's never going to be around again. So I have to. I'm going to watch the rest later, because that way there's something to look forward to in life.
I get it. I think this gentleman here, or you've got
line.
Okay.
From someone named Malcolm O'Hagan, I'm not quite sure.
Ah.
But he said you like to write about people with obsessions. Other than writing, do you have any obsessions?
Oh, that's a good question. I have serial obsessions where I, you know, get very interested in something. Often the thing I'm writing about, I get obsessed with, and it's like a form of transference, I guess. I do remember when I was writing about taxidermy, and I remember calling my husband, and I think he thought I was going to go to taxidermy school, because I was like, this is so cool. You can't believe I was at the World Taxidermy Championships. And, you know, I then started collecting taxidermy. We were doing this for a while, and I thought, where did this come from? Oh, I know. It kind of came across from doing the story. I mean, I certainly have hobbies and a lot of stuff that I love, but I am not, I've never fallen that deep the way the people I have written about do. I guess real estate, not a good hobby, but I would say I'm always a little bit arm's length, because I don't want to go too far the way I see people.
I did the library book as an audiobook, and I thought the narrator, who is you, was terrific. And I wanted to ask whether it was a difficult process getting the publisher to agree to you as a narrator, and also whether you ever read one of your sentences and thought, gee, I wish I had written that differently.
That's a great question, and painful. And actually, it's funny, it's very much on my mind, because I did just do the audiobook for Joyride and then the audiobook for The Orchid Thief. When I started, and when I wrote The Orchid Thief, audiobooks were a very niche part of publishing. And I think, you know, it was largely for people who were visually impaired, and it just, they were on CDs or cassettes. They, it was very clunky and not a big thing at all. You would sell handfuls, and they didn't generally have the author do the narration. They would have a professional narrator. By the time my next book came out, that had really changed. And first of all, audiobooks were growing, but secondly, people seemed to really like if the author, if you were a decent reader, to have the author do the narration. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. So I guess Rin Tin Tin was the first book that I narrated. No, I did my collections, and I was surprised by how much work it was, but I also really like reading and felt like I liked being the person doing it. And I think they got a good enough reaction that they said, oh, we'll do the next one. And with Joyride, absolutely, they said, oh, and I should say the library book, which is what you were referring to. There was never, if I could find the time, they wanted me to do it. So I went, the reason I did The Orchid Thief was because it was the only one of my books that I hadn't narrated. And I always had it in my mind that it would be nice if I'd done all of them. Also, it had been 25 years since the book had come out, so it was a chance to just sort of refresh it, and the quality of the recording is probably better. I mean, that was a long time ago. So, but it is a lot of work. But your other question about wanting to change things, you absolutely come across stuff where you think, oh, if I could only, but you're sort of contractually obligated to read it so it's exactly the same as the printed book, because it's like in the fine print that the audiobook is exactly the same as the published book. And there was a time when I was reading the library book where I literally was begging the producer and saying, can I really, just one word, can I take this out? I hate it. And she said, you know, I'm sorry, we can't. And we didn't. So, I mean, one thing with The Orchid Thief is we found a few typos, which was interesting. They had never been caught. So that we corrected. I mean, that's different. Yeah, you always see a sentence and think, ugh, if I could do it again, I would do it differently.
Hi, I'm a Cleveland girl, West Side.
Oh my God.
Lakewood. When you're not researching and working on your books, what books are stacked by your chair, by your bed? What are you reading right now?
I mostly read fiction. I've always loved fiction. I feel like it somehow is more kind of artistically stimulating for me to read fiction. But I'm about to begin a new book, and I will have to read a lot of nonfiction, so I don't mind it. I just, for pleasure, I read fiction. And I do, speaking of audiobooks, I got kind of hooked on audiobooks because I can read so much more. You know, I listen in the car, it's, if I'm sitting on a plane, I often don't like reading a book on the plane because the light's bad and it's somehow tiring, but I can listen to an audiobook for 4 hours and I love it. So that's been a new discovery. There's certain things you miss in an audiobook, but it's probably tripled the amount of reading I can do, and I love that.
Hi, I'm a freelance automotive journalist, and you're kind of a hero to all women automotive journalists back from when you profiled Jean Jennings for Fast Woman.
Yeah, so I love doing that.
That was such a great story. So as soon as I saw that the title of your memoir was called Joyride, I emailed my editor at Car and Driver, who also adores you, and she, I was like, I need to interview Susan Orlean because her book is called Joyride. And she was like, that's never going to fly at Car and Driver. I'm sorry. And I was like, but we could do it in a car and we can listen to the audiobooks and talk about audiobooks. And she's like, sorry, no.
Oh, but no, I'm crushed.
I am too. I'm devastated. But I mean, if I could find somewhere else to take the story, I'm happy to do it.
Also, I'm kind of into cars and I'm definitely into driving. So,
okay.
Yeah. And I grew up with a father who was really a car nut.
Oh my goodness.
For real.
Have you ever seen my stories in Car and Driving?
And my son is a car nut. So somehow I am car centric.
Okay. So my question is, I haven't read the book yet. So sorry if this is self-explanatory once I do, but so the title Joyride, I always think of a joyride as like you steal a car and go for a joyride. And I've read so much of your work and it always seems like you're looking for trouble. Like, would you say that's true?
That's so funny because so many people don't get that reference. The title came absolutely fully formed in my head. We had a working title that I didn't like. And the working title was True Story, which I just thought, it's fine. It didn't excite me, but you sort of need a working title. And I thought, how am I going to title a memoir? This is so tough. And it is. And book titles are hard anyway. I have had this picture of me in this bumper car on my computer desktop for years. It was taken by a friend. And I think somehow something clicked and I saw it and thought, Joyride. And I love that it had a couple of layers of meaning. On one hand, it's all about fun and adventure and joy, but it absolutely has that slightly little bit of a naughty kind of connotation of hot wiring a car and going for a drive. And at first I thought, well, that's really not relevant. But then I thought, and yet it is, because in so many ways, what I do is sort of hotwire someone else's life and ride it, and no one gets hurt. I return the car at the end of the ride. And I loved, you know, and it is a ride. It's, you are going on this adventure with, when you're writing about real things and real people. It just felt so apt, and knowing that I had this picture, it was instant, and everybody said, absolutely. And I have found people who don't know that joyride means stealing a car. but I loved that it was both full of delight, but also had a little bit of a wink of, you know, I'm going to be a little subversive and do something that's maybe not so totally down the middle.
With that, we should probably thank you for having a joyride with us tonight.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.